And welcome to Spectrum West, the final edition for March of 2016. Spectrum West, many voices talking about one active and animated chunk of Badger State, western Wisconsin, where we take the arts seriously and humorously and historically and satirically and musically, literally and figuratively. Today, Ellis Paul is one of music's best-kept secrets. If his live performances are anything near his recordings, it's going to be a fabulous show Friday night at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls. Jim Oliver previews the UW Stout rendition of a classic, Little Shop of Horrors. I have to say that, well, horrors, opening soon. UW Barron County explores Islam and will welcome an authority on intercultural diversity speaking Friday evening in Barron. And here's where we get this ball rolling. We're nearing the end of season 23 for the Master Singers, a group of songbirds whose name says it all. This is as good as it gets, and so if you haven't yet treated your ears to their vocal vitality, you have yet another opportunity this Sunday as they present their annual Choral Images Concert, this year in part honoring a president and the country he led. Master Singers director Gary Schwartzoff took my phone call in his university office on a typically busy day. I like the term choral images. You know, radio is famous for emanating the idea of theater of the mind, and although your audience will be able to physically see your ensemble, your voice is going to conjure up images, especially in the second half of the program. Is that what choral images means?
Yes, I would say so. I think the term is, first of all, we've used this term for many years to describe our final concert of the year. It's like Lesson in Carols of Christmas has been the main banner over that concert. Choral Images has been that for our last concert of the year here, the spring concert. It gives it a framework, if you would. It also gives it a chance to be fairly flexible. It just so happens that this particular year, the Choral Images will be that of our President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, as we recognize and honor the 32nd President of the United States, and what also besides him is what is known as our greatest generation, mm-hmm. who sacrificed so much for us during World War II.
Okay. So what's on the program? What kinds of things are we going to hear in something that honors Franklin Delano Roosevelt?
Well, initially, the first half of the program is a broader swipe about the history and sacrifice of our country, a piece entitled Homeland by Z. Randall Stroop, based upon Jupiter's theme by Gustav Holst, that is the planets, mm-hmm. a beautiful setting of that, with text in part from his own father, that is Z. Randall Stroop's father, who marched in the Bataan Death March in World War II. So there's that connection with World War II in that piece as well. A piece entitled Notes from Thomas Paine by the American composer Norman De La Gioia, which speaks of life and freedom. Take heed, for freedom is hunted round the globe, and bat-eyed men are regarded like a stranger. So it refers to, in my opinion, again, freedom around the globe and what we and allies fought for in World War II. One of FDR's favorite hymns, which he always had in services when Churchill, Stalin, and FDR met wherever in the world, sometimes at sea in a ship or on land, was Eternal Father Strong to Save. That was a favorite hymn of his. That's a piece actually the Masked Singers commissioned many years ago, well, 2013, from Dan Forrest.
My father was a Navy man. He used to sing that song.
Yes, I love that hymn tune. Mm-hmm. A piece in remembrance, sort of to eulogize FDR, it's entitled In Remembrance. On the text, Lux Aeterna, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord, may they rest in their labor. Mm-hmm. So it's our requiem to him, if you would. Then another piece that the Masked Singers commissioned entitled The Fall of Rome by Zachary Moore, our composer in residence for the year. This piece is on the words of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This is the fireside chat which Roosevelt gave on the eve of the D-Day invasion.
Ah, okay.
So that's the text for that piece. And then the second half of the program is commissioned work entitled A Destiny of Liberty set by Ethan Wickman, who used to teach here. Now he's at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
This five-movement work focuses on the four freedoms speeches, that FDR spoke of during his presidency. This was actually one of his State of the Union addresses. And much of this, the freedoms are freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of want, and freedom from fear. That's the essence of that piece. And then the program will conclude with a setting of America the Beautiful.
Wow. That's a pretty full show.
It is. It's one of, quite frankly, our most ambitious programs that the Masked Singers have taken on. It's very challenging music, especially the Ethan Wickman score.
It's kind of exciting, too. You guys are taking it on the road, and not just a couple of miles down the road.
Yes, this will be what is, in reality, the third President's Day concert in Washington, D.C. It's been a festival that I've been involved with since its inception. The first one was in 2009 with the 150th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln. In 2013, on the 50th anniversary or observance of the passing of John F. Kennedy, and now FDR here in 2016 on the 75th anniversary of the invasion of Pearl Harbor.
FDR, famous for saying, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," and the only thing Western Wisconsin has to fear is the Master Singers off-season, which comes after this. This is the last concert of the season, right?
Correct, it is. This will conclude our 23rd season.
Okay, so the 2016-2017 season. Any hints about that?
Well, programming yet to be taken care of over the summer. We are pleased to include an artist series. We've been invited to perform the Flambeau Artist Series here in Wisconsin, so we'll include that in our season. Lesson and Carols again, of course, and Choral Images will happen once again next spring in some manner.
The Master Singers, Where Many Become One. It's called Choral Images 2016, Four Freedoms, honoring Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It is Sunday, April 3rd, 2 p.m., First Congregational United Church of Christ in Eau Claire. Gary Schwartzoff, thanks for taking time out of your busy day to give us a first-hand preview. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Al.
Don't wait till next season. Sunday can be the day you enrich your life with the Master Singers. Tickets at the door. Coming up, have some fun with Little Shop of Horrors at UW Stout beginning April 7th. Get ready to hear Ellis Paul. He'll be a new favorite. And next, the issue of Islamophobia comes to Rice Lake and Barron on Friday. Support for WPR comes from Luther College, where campus visits can include talking with professors, coaches, and conductors, staying in residence halls, joining music rehearsals, and more. Visit information is at luther.edu. Support also comes from Mayo Clinic Health System, bringing Mayo Clinic care to communities throughout western Wisconsin, with specialties such as cardiology and heart surgery. Information on the web at mayoclinichealthsystem.org. Well, culture includes civilization, and today ours is being challenged by ideologies at right angles to each other. People like Dr. Amir Ahmed are working on the differences, the dissimilarities over which we clash. Friday evening, Ahmed, a Muslim, delivers the concluding keynote address of the UW-Barron County One World Global Art, Literature, and Film Series, this year Exploring Islam. His message is addressing Islamophobia, dispelling myths. He previously taught at universities in Minnesota, Iowa, and Michigan, and we contacted Dr. Ahmed at his home in Amherst, Massachusetts, where he now teaches at UMass. Born in Springfield, Ohio, so you have some Midwest roots.
Oh, yeah. I've lived most of my life in the Midwest. I've lived on the border of Wisconsin. I lived in Dubuque, Iowa for a couple of years and lived in Moorhead, Minnesota for a couple of years and spent a long time in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So most of my life I did a big wheel around the Midwest.
Well, Springfield has a couple of small colleges, I noticed, so there is some diversity there. So I'm wondering about your experience. Was it personal experience, maybe a bit of discrimination along the way that ignited the fire of desire, or some other epiphany that got your wheels rolling in the direction that you've been traveling?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was multiple dynamics. I mean, I went to a high school that was 40% black, 60% white, and then there was like me. and you know, you're talking about a post-industrial kind of reality. The major employer was International Harvester. You saw the diminishing blue-collar jobs over time. And a lot of people didn't go to college. A lot of people didn't even finish high school, but I did. And I watched my life change as I went to college and moving between South Asians who might have been Hindu or Christian or Muslim or Sikh or Jain, and then the Muslim community, which might have been Arab, Pakistani, you know, Indian, Malaysian, Somali, and then, you know, going out into kind of high school and moving between mostly black and white folks and experiencing the differences across those experiences, kind of primarily amongst white folks, had this experience of feeling like I was weird, like there was something wrong with me because, you know, I didn't drink and I didn't date and didn't eat pork. And these were things that were all kind of deemed odd or strange. And whereas, you know, my experience with black folks was very different. It was much more accepted. Uh-huh. Most everybody had a black Muslim uncle somewhere in their family. So people were kind of semi-familiar in some way, shape, or form. So they're like, oh, yeah, you know, we know that what that is. And I was moving across lots of different contexts, even though it seemed like a very straightforward middle American life. As I got older, I realized that wasn't necessarily true for other people, that experience of moving across. And then many people, you know, primarily operated within homogenous spaces in which, you know, they were primarily around people like themselves. And even if it wasn't homogenous spaces, they tend to stick with people like themselves.
Sure.
I really just didn't have a choice. You know, there was hardly anybody of my background. There was only a couple of the kids my age in my community.
Well, how's this for a wide-ranging skill set? Intercultural diversity consultant, college administrator, facilitator, poet, and hip-hop artist. Wow.
Prior to becoming a diversity consultant, working in higher education, I was a hip-hop activist first, you know, and an artist first. Really committed to using urban arts as a mode of activism and, you know, engaging and transforming communities and empowering people, especially young people. Yeah. I really felt strongly that the arts were a way of transforming people's lives and bringing people together across barriers that are oftentimes challenging to cross. And so, you know, it's just to be able to build networks in which people can really begin to see that their struggles are more connected than they realize. You know, oftentimes when you're marginalized, you feel isolated. You know, what we do in building connections, you know, the potential for solidarity and how do we start to see each other in each other's struggles and realize that we need each other to be able to transform our circumstances.
Now, for people in small Midwestern towns, Amir, whose exposure to Islam is often just hearing about and seeing its affiliation with hate and destruction on their TV set, how do they put their arms around what to them might appear as simply a public relations effort to put Islam in a better light? They don't have Muslims living in their midst, per se, and they're getting what they get from media.
Likely there are Muslims living in their midst, but they might not know them and have relationships with them and might not be very familiar with them. And in contrast to the representations that they're getting through the media, which are very particular and narrow. And so most people just don't have a lot of context. And so that's, you know, as an educator, you know, it's really important to be able to present context for people so that they understand that, you know, there's 1.7 billion Muslims in the world. Even if you just want to look at the Belgium attacks, I mean, literally, these are the same guys who were involved with the Paris attacks. It's not even like we're talking about vast numbers of people here, but there's also a history. You know, there's a history, and, you know, after 9/11, you know, we heard people say, you know, why do they hate us? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's rooted in a question that lacks context. It's rooted in, you know, the fact that, you know, our media is very, very narrow in its representation in this country, and that we're not well exposed to different things that are happening in the rest of the world. And beyond just most people are just living their lives and just trying to provide a good life for their families, we also lose the perspective of the consequences of U.S. intervention in so many different places in the world and the sentiment that creates for people. You know, most people aren't the kind of people who are going to take that sentiment and translate that into violence. But
you know, when your life has been destroyed because of war and because of our economic interests that have played out, and, you know, we forget that, you know, how many dictators we've supported and in so many different places, in fact, installed and democratically elected governments we've overthrown. And, you know, we oftentimes point to, you know, groups like the Taliban, groups like Al-Qaeda, you know, the Saudi regime. And we forget that the United States has had a hand in their having power and the imposition of their interpretations and their, you know, extreme understandings of Islam in relationship to their populations that they have power and control over. And so it creates a compounding effect of marginality for the people who are living under these repressive circumstances, beyond just the fact that people want to break free of the repression that they're living in. The fact that we absolve ourselves of our responsibility of what's led them into that circumstance and blame people for being in the conditions and circumstances that they are, that all speaks to the lack of context that we have in this society. There aren't a lot of counter-narratives, and the workshop that I'll be doing this week is really about, you know, presenting a counter narrative. It doesn't mean that I have the absolute truth. It doesn't mean that there is an absolute truth. It just means that there's a lot more to this conversation and story than people are really getting exposed to.
We're speaking with Dr. Amir Ahmed. He's Director of Intercultural Teaching at University of Massachusetts Amherst, presenting Addressing Islamophobia: Beyond the Myths, Breaking Down the Barriers, 7 o'clock Friday. That's at the Barron Area Community Center. The University of Wisconsin-Barron County is sponsoring the visit. Now, folks like yourself are expending sizable amounts of energy trying to infuse healthy acceptance and to inform the uninformed. Is there an equal amount of energy being applied to affecting the uncompromising faction of Islam that consistently provides Muslims with a bad name?
Well, I mean, I think that we have to ask the question, are people, you know, committing the same level of commitment to the KKK, you know, who claim themselves to be Christian? I think we all agree that ISIS is horrible. I mean, I don't think people fully understand how deeply unpopular ISIS is. Yeah. ISIS is the worst of the worst. But again, to what degree do I, as an American Muslim, have any responsibility other than the fact that I'm part of a country that invaded Iraq that ended up leading to the creation of ISIS? ISIS exists more because I'm an American than it is because of the fact that I'm Muslim. I mean, many of the people who started ISIS were Ba'athists in the Iraqi regime, you know, who worked for Saddam Hussein. These people weren't particularly religiously ideological at that time. And so, you know, again, that's why the context matters. Yes, do I, and does pretty much every American Muslim that I know, of course, abhor and detest this kind of violence in the name of our religion? Absolutely. But I think we also have to remember that we don't have any greater power than you do in determining what people on the other side of the planet or people who are, you know, extreme individuals, what they're able to do. Should we speak out? Absolutely. I think that we should all do what we can. I think we should all work together and to be able to understand each other in order to work together to be able to confront these challenges and not scapegoat and blame people simply because there's extremists manipulating these concepts and these ideas and therefore making the rest of us look bad.
We keep hearing about the fact that most of the conflict is based on religion. I don't know anything about the Quran. I have to think that the Quran at some place addresses sin and wrongdoing the same way the Bible does. The whole thing about the religious differences, the religious war, it just seems to be more political than religious to me.
I totally agree with that. You know, again, part of what I talk about in my presentation was if you base Islam based on what you got through the media, you'd think it was some satanic worshiping religion.
Yeah.
Islam overwhelmingly is like 98% similar to Christianity. You know, Jesus is the second to last prophet in Islam. The Virgin Mary and the virgin birth, there's a whole chapter about Mary. Abraham, Isaac, Ishmael, these are all prophets talked about in our holy book, the Quran. So people who are familiar with Christian texts would be very familiar with a lot of what they're reading in the Quran. Even more similar is Judaism and Islam. I mean, very similar. The scholar Reza Aslan talks extensively about it's really more about what we bring to our religion. And that, like, speaks to what you're talking about, the politics or the rationalizations or the justifications that people will bring to justify things that are unjustifiable. But yet they can use religion and extract religion, religious concepts, like even this concept of jihad. Well, jihad does not mean holy war. Jihad actually translates to struggle. the greater jihad is a spiritual struggle to navigate the moral and ethical dilemmas of daily life, to be God conscious, to try to make the right choices as best you can. That's the greater jihad. But then there's a lesser jihad, which is a physical interpretation, and there's the idea that you have the right to defend yourself when under attack. And that's no different from our laws here in the United States, which is rooted in Judeo-Christian principles of, you know, you have the right to self-defense, but you don't have the right for premeditated murder. And so 99.9% of Islamic scholars will all agree that the manipulation of this concept of jihad is unjustifiable in any reasonable interpretation of Islamic teaching.
Well, I should point out that within the span of just a few days and the span of just a few miles, yourself and Reza Aslan will be appearing in our midst. Reza is coming to the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire April 6th to conclude the 2015-2016 Forum Series, presenting a talk, Beyond Fundamentalism, Religion, Tolerance, and the Modern World.
Absolutely. So, he's a brilliant scholar, and I'm really glad to hear people are going to get an opportunity to see him. And I'll certainly let people know to whatever degree I have the details to make sure people know he's coming, because I fully endorse his work. And again, he's a religious scholar. I'm not a religious scholar. And I'm more in a better position to help people learn about social, cultural, historical, and political context.
The two main words that you and I have been talking about are in your title of your talk, which is Myths and Barriers, obviously. So So people like us are just simply looking for some perspective and some clarity. Mm-hmm. How can people in my neighborhood engage in this topic and in becoming a bit more learned and having a healthy perspective on all this after you've left Wisconsin? What kinds of things can we do to further the cause of understanding and maybe a bit more kumbaya?
I definitely encourage people to learn more about the religion of Islam, engage the local community, build relationships, build partnerships. You know, our community needs allies. We're really under assault right now. My parents came to this country in 1967. We're here. We're part of this country with some Congress people, comedians, artists, doctors, engineers. The things that get justified in the name of Islamophobia undermines the civil liberties and rights of everybody. So the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act undermines the civil liberties of every American, right? But it's under the guise there's something suspicious about our community. So therefore, you know, we have to undermine the civil liberties of all Americans. And, you know, of course, right now we're hearing about things like not allowing Muslims into the country. And of course, we hear Senator Ted Cruz talking about patrolling Muslim neighborhoods, which don't really exist, actually. So if you patrol Muslim neighborhoods who mostly live in integrated neighborhoods with other communities and groups of people, that means you're authorizing more patrolling of everybody who lives in that community. We're less than 1% of the population of this country. We need allies. We need people to learn more about us, to engage us, to learn more about the religion of Islam, realize that Muslims are God-fearing individuals, or very spiritual-minded, very family-oriented. That's my experience. Yeah. The American Muslim population, and even beyond. I mean, I've had great experiences with Muslims all over the world, and I'm thankful for those experiences.
Amir Ahmed, thanks so much for being with us on Spectrum West. We appreciate your willingness to visit us and engage with us. I know that you're not always preaching to the choir when you come visit people like us, but again, we appreciate your willingness to share what you know. Hopefully, we will return the favor.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to being there.
We delve only as deeply as two can in 14 minutes, but you can continue the conversation Friday evening at 7 at the Barron Area Community Center. There's no charge, and it's not just enlightening, it kind of feels like a responsibility, like voting. Still to come on Spectrum West, you'll meet and greet Ellis Paul performing Friday night at the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls. First, Jim Oliver's here. We begin the Oliver Interval. Try to say that fast three times. Oliver Interval. With what's on stage in Western Wisconsin.
Thanks, Al. Glorious, the true story of Florence Foster Jenkins, the worst singer in the world, will be performed Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays through April 17th at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will perform Disney's The Little Mermaid next Thursday through Sunday at the State Theater in Eau Claire. Little Shop of Horrors will be staged by the UW Stout Theater next Thursday through Saturday and the following Friday and Saturday at the UW Stout Harvey Hall Theater in Menominee. Teens on Stage will perform Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Macbeth, April 6th through the 10th, at the Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake. Unnecessary Farce will be staged Fridays and Saturdays through May 21st at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. And the Great River Road Theater will hold auditions for Beauty and the Beast from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Sunday and Monday in the Prescott Middle School cafeteria.
Well, while we have him, I don't think we should let him get away. Jim's on the theater beat this week, and it takes him to Menominee for something UW Stout has up their sleeve. Literally.
The Little Shop of Horrors is a horror comedy rock musical by composer Alan Menken and writer Howard Ashman. The musical is based on the low-budget 1960 black comedy film The Little Shop of Horrors. The UW Stout Theater will stage the play from April 7th to the 9th and the 15th and the 16th at the University's Harvey Hall Theater in Menominee. On the telephone to talk about the play is the director, Professor Paul Kallenberg, director of theater at UW Stout. Thanks a lot for coming on to talk to us.
Thank you.
So why did whoever does the play selecting, you I assume, decide on producing The Little Shop of Horrors?
Well, a lot goes into the process, but the main reason I chose this particular show was the enthusiasm from the students when I put it out there as a possible production for the spring, and the response was overwhelmingly positive and enthusiastic, and I thought if there was that much energy and support for the production, that it seemed like the right choice, and so we went forward with it.
Now, it has a pretty large cast. Maybe that has something to do with the students wanting to do it.
Well, actually, we have a cast of 11. So it's a little bit more towards the small side, but I was surprised that it was so popular with students yet, because you go back to the movie and Broadway productions and that, and I thought it was past its prime, but it's still one of the most produced plays in the high school circuit. Students just brighten up when you talk about the musical.
Mm-hmm. Well, without giving up any secrets, tell us as much as you can about the play.
Well, I don't know if there are really too many secrets about it anymore, but it's a fantastical journey through a young man's life, and he works in a Skid Row flower shop, and somehow he stumbles along this strange new plant. And the plant turns out to be from an alien planet, so to speak, and ends up being able to speak and ends up surviving by the consumption of human blood. So that's the premise of the story, and it just takes off from there in lots of zany and fantastical places.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the technical aspects of the play. Years ago, a friend of mine built the set for a production of it, said it was one of the most challenging things he had ever done. I don't know what the set would look like or anything else, but how does that work for you? Do you have students doing the set building and that sort of thing?
Well, we have our resident lighting and scenic designer is Professor Jennifer Sandsfaken, and she's in charge of designing it, and then we have student crews and classes that work on the construction and the painting and the implementation of that design. One of the features of the show is that the plant is a puppet, and so there are different manifestations of the plant as it grows. Mm-hmm. And as in many theaters, instead of putting the time into building the plant, which can be very time-consuming and expensive, end up renting the puppet. There are places all around the country that rent the puppets for the show, and that's the avenue we took. So our puppets are from a rental agency.
So I take it then there is more than one?
There are four manifestations of the plant as it grows throughout the play.
Okay. He is Paul Kallenberg, director of the UW Stout production of The Little Shop of Horrors. Well, it's a musical, so talk a little bit about the music. First, what are some of the songs that we will be listening to? I think some of them are sort of familiar to most of us.
I think some of them are familiar. It's a pop rock score and a soul R&B a little bit as well. And it takes you through a lot of different genres, upbeat, fun style, and then there are some pop ballads. So it's a kind of rollicking score, lots of fun, lots of of interesting things. Lyrics are really key. There are a lot of clever lyrics that really tell the story and help get the atmosphere of this whole zany musical across.
Now, is there a choreography with it, too, as well?
Yeah, there's choreography. It's not a big song and dance musical like Anything Goes or something like that, but there's appropriate choreography. The story mostly, though, is told through the book and the music and lyrics.
Well, talk about who's the choreographer, who's directing them. Do you have a pit orchestra, or do you have recorded music?
We have a live orchestra. Mm-hmm. It's a combo of seven musicians. Mm-hmm. I'm the director and the choreographer for the production.
Oh, okay.
Erica Savoni is the music director. She is the band director at Augsburg College in the cities. So she's here also doing our musical direction for Little Shop of Horrors.
Uh-huh. Well, are there significant set changes and technical things and lighting and all of that kind of stuff that goes on during the show?
There are a few minor set changes. It all takes place basically in the interior of the flower shop mm-hmm. and outside on the Skid Row street. So the set itself doesn't have a lot of different changes or manifestations. Lighting-wise, we'll be using a lot of lighting to help create the sense and the suspense and the horror and the terror, all in a tongue-in-cheek type of way, to get that across. So it'll be a heavily lit show with a lot of energy and changes in terms of the lighting.
Tell us what some of the songs are that we might recognize.
I think Suddenly Seymour and Someplace That's Green are two of the most recognizable songs, I think, within the production itself. Mm-hmm. And then the title song, Little Shop of Horrors. Uh-huh. I think the audience would be surprised how many songs they do recognize once they come to the production, but they maybe didn't realize it was from the show or what the title of the number was.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the overall theater program at UW-Stout. How does it tie into the general curriculum of the university, and what would be some goals of students who are involved in the theater program?
Well, one of the nice things about our program is that it's open to all students. Mm-hmm. We do have a performing arts minor now on campus, and so we're tied together with the music area to offer an array of classes that make up an 18-credit minor in the performing arts. And we draw a lot from a lot of different students and a lot of different disciplines. And a lot of times the program directors and instructors and students don't realize the close connection we have with other fields and that how their field can really be applied to many of the elements in terms of theater, in terms of things like industrial designers and engineers and instruction management majors, in terms of some of the tech eds, apparel design, crossing over into the costume area. So there's a lot of outreach that we're trying to connect to other programs, and we're getting a lot of a real positive response. And then just in general terms, as part of a university, you know, the arts and theater specifically are important to the overall universal education that we provide here at Stout. So it's a vital role in terms of bringing live theater and the performing arts to the students and to the local community as well.
Well, tell us how we can get tickets to see the show.
Tickets are available online at tickets.uwstout.edu. You can also reserve them at the MSC service desk at 715-232-1413. Mm-hmm. All tickets are $12.
Ah, well, that's a pretty cheap date, I would say.
Yes, it's not bad, is it?
Well, we've been talking to Paul Collenberg, director of the UW-Stout Theater production of The Little Shop of Horrors. The show runs April 7th through the 9th and the 15th and the 16th at the university's Harvey Hall Theater in Menominee. Paul Collenberg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, in case the old pencil wasn't out when the outlets were recited, here are the ticket avenues again. Online at tickets.uwstout.edu and by phone at 715-232-1413. Jim Oliver and his interesting, illuminating guests icing on our Spectrum pastry each week. Thanks to all. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, presenting 10 exhibitions per year and home to masterworks by Monet, O'Keeffe, and Leutze's Washington Crossing the Delaware, mmam.org. Support also comes from the National Eagle Center in Wabasha, Minnesota, celebrating Hatch Day, April 22nd through the 24th, with cupcakes, white pine saplings, and Eagle birthday events. NationalEagleCenter.org/events. I don't know what to say about our next guest other than to admit I'm one part embarrassed and one part discouraged. Humiliated because before this week I hadn't heard of Ellis Paul, a dang good singer and writer of songs, and frustrated because I could have been listening all these years and I've denied myself the pleasure.
Don't slow down, keep the ceiling spinning around. If you slow, you know the truth will catch you tomorrow. You think the bottom of a glass holds peace, whiskey brings you sweet relief, but it's a liar, it's a thief. You can't drink away your sorrows. Was I lying to you? Was I lying to myself? Now I'm lying wide awake. I wanted to run to you so my eyes could see your face. Someone's lying at my place.
But you know, looking on the bright side of Better Late Than Never, I'm going to enjoy Ellis Paul now and am pleased to present his story and talent here on the radio. The Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls goes me one better. They're putting him on their stage live Friday night. He has some roots in the state of Maine, and we talked with him from his home in Virginia earlier this week. I have to do a lot of research, of course, when I speak with people for our weekly radio program, and I have to say, researching you turned out to be one of the more fun experiences.
Oh, that's good.
Well, you got some,
I'm glad to hear that.
You got some cool stuff going on, things that I think our audience should know. I'm not going to ask you where it is, but I want to tell them that you have a Woody Guthrie tattoo.
Yes, that's, I do.
You were a track star who wanted to be a social worker. You were in the Maine Music Hall of Fame. Tell me about the Maine Music Hall of Fame, just to the extent of, okay, we know that Ellis Paul is in it now. Anybody else famous that we should know about that's in that hall?
Don McLean is in it, who wrote, you know, Vincent and American Pie. He's in it.
Yeah.
And a guy named Howie Day, who had a more recent hit. A guy named Dave Mallett, who did Inch by Inch, Row by Row, a famous folk song, is in it.
The Garden Song.
Yeah, that's right.
I know that song.
It's a classic.
Tell our audiences about your episodes in the woodshed with a candle and wine and a guitar.
Those are my woodshed days where I was learning how to write songs. I lived in Wayland, Massachusetts on a beautiful farm that had a great shed space to write. And so I wouldn't keep my roommates up. I went out there late at night, generally between like 10 and 2 or 3 in the morning. Mm-hmm. I would just work on songs and play guitar and drink a little wine and try and find the muse wherever it was hiding.
Mm-hmm. The bug had already bitten you, or was that the time that you did realize that this was what you were going to be doing for the rest of your days?
Well, that was the plan. I didn't know for sure whether it would hold or not, but I've quit my day job when I was 26, and it's been 25 years since, so it's been working pretty well.
I've read that you have said, and you probably continue to contend, that writing songs is medicinal for you. You really need it.
Yeah, you know, I think there's something to be said about that creative process. You know, when you find a groove and it really feeds the soul and your mental state and gives your life meaning, and that's what writing does for me. And hopefully I'll do it until I can't.
I read the transcript of a speech you gave when you were kind of the keynote guy.
It might have been the Northeast Folk Alliance conference.
Yep.
Yeah, that was just a speech on music and my career and the idea of what community means, especially to folk music, because it's not a commercial music form. It's more about playing to volunteer groups and that kind of thing. So it's a little bit harder to make the big money.
I remember looking at that acronym for that group, thinking that it was kind of funny sounding.
NERFA, right, yeah.
So it was exciting and educational in the early days for you. That's where you got your energy. Now that you have the equivalent of a PhD simply by virtue of all the stuff you've done over the years, where does the energy come from these days?
Well, it's still valuable for me to be on stage, that the touring and traveling and...
I should point out to our audience that you do nearly a couple hundred shows a year. Still?
Yeah, still a pretty heavy schedule, and that's becoming harder and harder, but the shows themselves I still love, and meeting people and hearing stories and, you know, getting to talk to people after shows, so that's still very valuable to me, and I really enjoy it.
A lot of our audience may be saying, Ellis Paul, I don't have any of his CDs. His claim to fame is the fact that you're prolific. You're also very good. I've watched a lot of the YouTube videos of the stuff that you've written. You've also written things that we may recognize if we were to visit, you know, a movie or two or a television show or a commercial. What are some of those?
Well, I've had a few songs in some major movies. Me, Myself, and Irene, which is a Jim Carrey movie. I had the end credit score song on. Mm-hmm. And then most recently, a movie named Nellie Bly, 10 Days in a Madhouse, came out, and I've got a song in that movie. You know, occasionally there are television shows and movies that will have my songs in them, and it's probably the way the majority of people have discovered me over the years.
Mm-hmm. We're on the phone with Ellis Paul, singer-songwriter extraordinaire, coming Friday, April 1st, 7:30 p.m. to the Heidi Center for the Arts. That's in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. The Heidi Center for the Arts is in a town of about 13, almost 14,000 people. But that's right in your wheelhouse, isn't it? I mean, those are the kind of venues that you really enjoy visiting, and they are among all of those many shows you do every year.
You know, I like doing little theaters and opera houses in towns. It's about the size of the town that I grew up in Maine, and you know, I connect good with an audience that's got the same kind of values and comes from the same kind of place I did.
You talk a lot about the reasons, the whys and the wherefores that, you know, you're involved in music and why performing it and writing it is so precious to you. Because I think the term that I either read or applied to it is there's commingling in music. It's kind of why I heard you say in something I read that that's why it's precious to people. For instance, you write a song about your father, and the people out there in the seats see their father in the song.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about this as an art form, and I think maybe books do it a little bit as well, but with music, you only have 3 or 4 minutes to get your ideas across, and no matter what you're writing about, the person listening is going to interpret it according to his own, you know, set of circumstances and experiences. And so, you know, a love song is going to include people from their lives and their heads, and their emotional memory is going to reflect those people when the song comes up. So I think it's more personal as an art form because of that. You're not provided with all the details like you are in movies and in paintings and photography and, and dance and things like that.
I like the fact that that you just seem to love what you do. That's what I find refreshing, and that's why I think I'm going to head to Chippewa Falls and maybe catch you Friday night, because I enjoy entertainers who do it for more than just a check. That's cool.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. I read a brief passage about your life, quote-unquote, falling apart. There must have been a chapter there. No need for any details, but I'm wondering if that episode, a lot of us have them. Did it turn out to be a song windfall for you?
Yeah, you know, life is a never surprising roller coaster, so you have to write about those events because it's the best way to deconstruct them in your mind and move forward. Yeah, anything that's happened to me, even the good stuff, gets written about. Music is it's a way of mending yourself and improving yourself, and hopefully improving the lives of the people that hear it as well. Uh-huh. So it's always a good amount of medicine for me to pick up a guitar and write.
You really like hanging out with people, too. I mean, so much of show business or the music business and success at it turns out for a lot of people to be just right place, right time. But you have a different take on that. Your take includes right people. I mean, you've made people that you've run into and people you may have met only once building blocks to what it is you do and your success.
Yeah, you know, I try and hear people out and hear what their stories are. But you can boil down a person's life to one epic moment in their life. It somehow explains where they've gone and where they're going and who they've become. And mm-hmm. I like those conversations. So you can have them at a bar or at a diner or after a show or on a subway car. It's those little nugget stories are essential to our lives. And storytelling in general is so important for our understanding of each other. Yeah, I sometimes wish with all the stuff going on in the broader world with between Muslims and Christians and all these opposing political factions that we could just intermingle our stories and understand each other better and maybe we'd get to a more peaceful planet as a result.
Interesting you say that, because a guest on this week's show is Amir Ahmed, and he is coming to the University of Wisconsin-Barron County to talk about Islamophobia. That's pretty timely that you brought that up. Another thing timely is that in that last explanation, you used the term boil down, which in spring has to do with maple syrup.
It's a good time to be alive.
No kidding. You have no illusions about what you do, according to what I believe now after reading about you. No illusions about how you do it. This isn't just the Ellis Paul show. You want people to know that you've had a bunch of help.
Well, yeah, I've always had a great manager in my life, my manager, Ralph Jack. He's been around for 25 years, and a great booking agency, and a lot of help from family and friends along the way. It's done fundraising for records to put records out, and it's been a community environment from the very beginning.
Another quote I really like that I read about you is that you say that you discover who you are in every song. It sounds like something that's made for a memoir, but it's true.
It is true. Even if I'm writing about other people, you get a sense and better understanding of yourself and putting things down on paper. You know, a lot of art is unconscious, and you know, you might see a Van Gogh painting of corn and crows, and it's just a painting of a field and the sky. But the color scheme reveals a lot about his internal makeup and his own pain. And I think any kind of artwork is like that. It's filtered through mm-hmm. your unconscious mind, and I think my songs are like that.
Just to complete this well-rounded image I've been giving everybody of you, you have a teaching tab on your website. That was also exemplary. Teaching, mentoring, that's kind of important to you?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I had a lot of mentors in my life, people like, you know, Bill Morrissey and Pete Seeger and all these older musicians who reached down and shared wisdom and suggestions with me. And I want to keep the chain alive and kicking. And so I spend a lot of time with other musicians teaching songwriting and teaching editing and, you know, word craft and that kind of thing and performance skills.
You're not only a music writer, songwriter, you have been involved in a documentary or two, poetry, short stories, and kids' books. What kind of kids' books would an Ellis Paul produce?
Well, I have a couple kids of my own, so I started writing music for them as well.
Ah.
The songs are, you know, they fall in line with the educational, folky kind of songs that you'd expect a folk singer to do. They're little biographies of famous Americans that have been turned into books.
Uh-huh.
People like Rosa Parks and Jackie Robinson and Albert Einstein. The book has done very well. It's called The Hero in You, and Scholastic named it the number one book for teachers in 2014. So it's in schools and libraries, and it's pretty easy to find online.
Congratulations on that. Way to go.
Thank you.
So this is a guy we've been talking to, Ellis Paul, who he's got a lot of miles on a couple cars. In fact, I did read something about a 400,000-mile car, I think, which is more than impressive to me. You must be a wrench as well. I don't know. Or you've got one that you know and like very well.
I have a reliable Honda CR-V with me right now. It's got 555,000 miles on it.
Oh, my.
Second engine and second transmission, but it's still been a great car and keeping me on the road, which is great.
You got to go through a few Wisconsin winters, and then those cars won't last that long. You
know, that's I'm glad I'm in the South.
Ellis Paul, nearly a couple hundred shows a year. He's got 20 albums to his name, about a million songs, I think. And the reason that I think people should go see you and hear you sing is that it's not just a show for you, it's a chapter. That's the way I think I've come to realize it in your life. So you're much more than just a singer-songwriter. We appreciate you coming to our midst, and we also appreciate you being a guest on Spectrum West. I hope that you keep in touch with us and let us know your future escapades, and we'll follow you down the road.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm looking forward to Chippewa Falls. Make sure you say hi.
6 o'clock, the alarm starts ringing, brings me out of a dream. I stumble down to the car, scrape the ice till the window's clean. I'm waiting on a break, chasing down a long tomorrow. Waiting on a break soon. 8 o'clock, hit the shop, turn the lock, turn the heat on. People coming by their hammers, by their nails to build a dream on. I'm waiting on a break, chasing down a long tomorrow.
That's Ellis Paul. I Am Hooked. You want to hear more of them? Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls, Friday night, is where you can do that. Well, the old clock on the wall says Spectrum West is history for another week. Almost, anyway. Here's some Spectrum memos. Brothers Teague and Ian, better known as the hobo nephews of Uncle Frank, bring their superb roots music to the Mabel Tainter in Menominee Friday evening at 7:30. The website is mabeltainter.org. Chippewa Valley Museum is hosting Wisconsin 101, Our History and Objects, Tuesday, April 5th, from 6 to 8 p.m. It's a collaborative public history project exploring Wisconsin's history through things. It's free and open to the public. Learn more at wi101.org. Tickets are on sale for the annual Fashion Without Fabric show Saturday the 16th of April in the Great Hall at UW Stout. Tickets at the Student Center Service Desk. Oh, yeah. April showers will bring flowers in May. Jessica, Debbie, and Dean make my day. Next week, April is Poetry Month. Echo wraps up another season. Tom Joad wanders into St. Croix Falls. And the Chippewa Valley Roller Girls add to the culture of West Wisconsin. Oh, yes, they do. I'm Al Ross. Thanks. See you next week.